That's what I'm telling you. This guy pops out of nowhere and says he'll take the job. No, he says he just wants to help. So no, I'm not gonna trust him. But I will meet with him. Well, because DeForest isn't getting any better, and that thing's gonna kill us the first chance it gets. So just keep an eye out. If the guy is legit, he's probably a lunatic. If he's not legit, light him up.
I'm gonna kill you, Opti! You and all your little crows! Let me out of here and you'll see!
Yeah. So, take her back downstairs, please. I gotta get back to work. Greetings and salutations, O ye of little freedom! Coming to you straight from the most reliably biased source on the Matrix, broadcasting as a proud member of the Shadowcasters Network, I am Opti, and welcome to the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. I am back behind the cobalt blue Shadowcasters microphone. My magical focus transmits truth from my lips to your ear holes. We're going to tackle 2074 today, but we're splitting it up into two episodes, like we've been doing lately, so we don't miss a thing. We're closing in on the end of Season 4, so keep your pants on for more pulse-pounding action. But first, as always, we're going to enhance some lives by answering some of our Dear Opti questions. First one comes from Tessa. Question, Dear Opti, is there any run that you would never, ever, not for a crapload of Nuyen, want to do again? Oh, yeah. Tessa, there's a few of them. I don't do insect spirits very well. I had a bad experience the first time. And the second time. And every time's following since the first time. I tried to get Red, Lothan, Quantum Princess, Detective Rider, Becky 99, and a bunch of Corp Johnsons together to do something about the bug problem here in Chicago. And where did that get me, huh? In a plate of trouble with nothing to show for it. So I'm done going after bugs. Let Ares do what they're going to do with the bugs. They deserve each other. Next question comes from Corey Regan. Dear Opti, my team tends to resort to brute force kick in the door tactics more often than not, even earning the nickname the Wrecking Crew at one point. How can I convince them, the meathead Minotaur Street Sam especially, that the subtle approach is often a better choice? Well, listen, Corey, convincing people to stop doing what they really want to do is just not a great idea for them or you. Chances are, they either like the style that they have fun with it, or they have childhood issues that they're working out through wanton violence. And unless you can get them into therapy more than a few times a week, I doubt very much that whatever they replace the self-medication of violent shadowrunning with is going to be not so much better. So, either learn to roll with your team and support the crazed wackos you've chosen to associate with, or find some new compadres. Our final question comes from Grover Dunn. Dear Opti, Grover asks, what was the first spell that you intentionally cast, and why? Whoa, Grover, that's a really interesting question. I remember the first unintentional spell I cast, but the first time I did it on purpose, well, it must have been when I was 15 or so. I think it was a mind net spell, but don't laugh. My dog taught it to me. It's easy to look back now and figure that I was just being led by a mentor spirit, but back then, I just figured my dog Julius was super special. Anyway, I used the spell to chat with one of my classmates at the Detroit Ares Academy. That's when they caught me and put me in this special track for mages. That was the beginning of the end for me, chummer. Well, keep those questions coming in. You can get them to me on the Face Matrix tweet box or shoot me a message at opti@neo-anarchist.com. And I will make your lives enhanced by answering them. And now, the moments that Season 4 have been leading up to, giving you the nitty and the gritty. Here's 2074, minus the Azatlan Amazonia War dragon stuff and virtually anything that happened in Denver. First, up in geopolitics. In 2074, the Sioux Nation sent in their special operation force, the Wildcats, to stop a Shadim infestation in Flat Willow, an abandoned town that used to be the turf of some gangers. When the Wildcat assault was over, Flat Willow was on fire, and the Shadim were pushed back into a nearby mine. Unfortunately, the Shadim escaped again, took over the town, and are still there to this day. On July 1st, the second, or revised, Treaty of Denver expired, leaving widespread uncertainty about the future of Denver, Seattle, and the North American nations. Later in July, Lance Jennings, who was a former Cass congressional representative, was arrested by Renraku when he went to a job interview at a Renraku facility. Neither Renraku nor the Cass government responded to any information requests. And you know who I blame for the governments and the corporations not responding to information requests? I blame us all. It is a rare moment anymore that corporations or governments feel even the slightest bit of accountability. As the days go by, we simply learn to ignore even the most egregious or nonsensical explanations or machinations just because speaking out in this climate involves a commitment to finding the truth, a commitment to following the leads, and a commitment to endure the consequences. And we simply do not have the will. Most of us don't anyway. We'd rather sit around and play Labyrinths and Lamassus or Darkness Run than do anything about it. Well, not here. Truth and its consequences are welcome in Opti's Maison. Well, in August, Brock Onijingo, an Evo Marine, along with his unit, boarded another Evo vessel, the Akula Krov, and opened fire on two other ships from the same group during a training exercise in the South Pacific. They started heading for Hawaii to attack and were dropped by a Thor shot from orbit. Brock sent multiple messages to his wife from a single comlink, but they all seemed to suggest that he had no recognition of what he was doing. More CFD madness, I suppose, although the details were never released. All throughout 2074, the queen of the ghoul nation of Osamondo, Themalaula, was welcoming metahumans infected with HMHVV into her land as the worldwide anti-infected sentiment continued to rise. She called for infected folks to stop trying to be accepted by the non-infected and to exist as they are, calling such ideas doomed. This pro-infected rhetoric proved successful, and many worldwide flocked to Osamondo and accepted Themalaula as their queen. However, on November 16th, Themalaula collapsed from a heart attack between the throne room and the press room just before a scheduled national address. Themalaula, founder and first queen of Osamondo, died shortly thereafter on November 25th. Themalaula's daughter Ronnie devours her mother's heart, as is ritually expected, and is crowned queen of Osamondo. Ronnie Lala's first decree is to declare a 44-day period of mourning, one day for each year of Themalaula's reign. On December 16th, five Tsimshian politicos, including three council candidates and two incumbents, start showing signs of early-onset dementia. Now, Crows, that's only the generic stuff that happened in 2074, if you can even call that generic. What I mean is that all the other notable events are part of larger cataclysmic shifts that occurred in 2074, so I broke them up for your ease of listening. Seattle politics follows next. But the events concerning Denver, the Aztlan-Amazonian War, and the Dragon Civil War are going to have to wait until next time. In the meantime, here's what was going down in Seattle in 2074. When Knight Errant won the Seattle law enforcement contract over Lone Star, they wanted to make a big splash and go with a different approach than their predecessors. As a result, they went after the Blood Mountain Boys gang in order to make an example out of them. This new tough-on-gangs approach took its toll on the Blood Mountain Boys, and from 2074 to 2075, Knight Errant virtually hamstrung the gang, putting other Seattle-based gangs on notice. In February, unidentified drones were spotted patrolling Seattle's northeast border. The Metroplex Guard placed the border on lockdown as a result. In March, three arrest warrants were issued by Seattle's Attorney General's office for individuals connected to advertising for Proposition 23. The individuals were sinless, so it was a bit harder to find them, but the advertisements in question, along with a bunch of other stuff, were misleading versions of the Proposition 23 text. This didn't stop anyone from further shenanigans on both sides, however. Of course, Prop 23 was the legislation that would give formal recognition to Seattle's Orc Underground as an official district, giving it access to city services, policing, etc. And who wouldn't want that? Well, you'd be surprised. For one, Governor Kenneth Brackhaven and Seattle's criminal element were both on the same side for once. Brackhaven, of course, didn't want those filthy orcs and trolls becoming full members of Seattle and having to give them the same services that other people got. While the criminals were afraid, and with good reason, that if the Orc Underground went legit, it would make it harder to escape the eyes of the law, and might even mean more scrutiny for the orcs and the sinless who live there. Well, metahuman racism amped up in 2074 because of the Prop 23 issue. And for just one example, Knight Errant arrested a certain Harriet Leonardwood for impeding a Knight Errant investigation. In reality, Miss Leonardwood was investigating the death of a sinless orc named George right in front of a Knight Errant precinct. This had gained national media attention, so instead of dealing with that black eye, it was easier to shut Miss Leonardwood up. In that same month, Special Prosecutor Gerald Worthington was killed by a hit-and-run driver as he took his early morning jog on a jogging path. Officials scratched their precious little heads and wondered aloud about how strange and random it was that the car happened to be on the jogging path at all. It should come as no surprise that Worthington was appointed to investigate corruption in the FBI and had specifically been checking into the amount of corporate influence that existed in the upper leadership of the Bureau. In May, Knight Errant began to investigate the recent arms theft from the Metroplex Guard Armory. Brackhaven's office had no official comment on allegations that the weapons were sold to violent anti-metahuman groups. In Renton, FBI Supervisory Special Agent Jennifer Kowalski was found dead at an extraterritorial site owned by Renraku. The FBI had to go through a mess of red tape in order just to cut her down from the flagpole. Neither Renraku nor the FBI made any public comment, not even officially acknowledging the event. Color me surprised. July saw hackers release the membership of documents of the Seattle Green Party and release them to the public. 3,461 financial contributors to the Green Party were identified by their name, SIN number, and account numbers. All but 66 of those names were laid off from local Seattle firms in the following months. Also that month, Knight Errant began deploying additional seeker teams to monitor the borders of the Redmond Barrens to try to stop drug traffic out of the Barrens. It had limited success. Now, you know, the Barrens have ways into downtown that the cops don't know about. Just ask the Halloweeners. But to show you how racist things were really getting, two young orcs died while vandalizing private property in Renton. Knight Errant ran out and nabbed the families of the orcs, number one, so they could identify the youths, and then two, so that they could demand that the families pay Knight Errant the cost of the police response. Ugh. Soon after, a group of terrorists destroyed a border security point south of Puyallup. The suspects led Knight Errant on a chase through that Seattle district. In response to the burgeoning political chaos, Governor Kenneth Brackhaven vowed to promote peace and order in Seattle, regardless of how Proposition 23's vote turned out. But October 2074 saw a rash of high-profile murders in Seattle. First, the Seattle District Attorney David Beatty was killed, and it was soon discovered that his office staff and their families were killed as well. And also killed was the entire Project Freedom staff. Of course, Project Freedom was the alternate name for the group that was promoting Proposition 23. Beatty had been a proactive and popular DA due to his fair-minded and aggressive handling of crimes related to the upcoming Prop 23. Acting District Attorney Dana Oakes, formerly an assistant DA, refused to go into hiding despite pleas from staffers and friends. Now say what you want about Oakes. I've run into her a couple times myself. But she is fair, she's determined, and her soul is made of iron. When the election finally rolled around, the results were mixed. The election was held on November 4th and saw Governor Brackhaven beat his rival, Eliza Bloom, to keep the governorship. On the other hand, Prop 23 passed, and the Orc Underground became an official district of Seattle. Of course, history unveils that the Orc Underground has been less and less kind to orcs since Prop 23 passed. Hardly anyone calls it the Orc Underground anymore, and they call it the Seattle Underground, the official title. It saw entrepreneurs and more than its fair share of wealthy metahumans flood in, gentrifying the area rather quickly. Now, it's hardly the change that the orcs had hoped for. Just before the election in November, a UCAS FBI agent named Seth Dietrich disappeared while investigating a criminal conspiracy against the Orc Underground led by Governor Brackhaven. Dietrich had uploaded evidence of this conspiracy to a number of data havens, including Jackpoint, just before his appearance. These files, while ultimately not released in time to change the election, detailed Brackhaven's involvement in Operation Daybreak, funding the genocide of orcs in the underground, and blaming it on the inherent dangers of having so many orcs in one place. It also included killing unfavorable DAs like David Beatty and getting rid of Project Freedom. That document is now increasingly hard to track down on the Matrix as it is being actively searched for and scrubbed. You're welcome for the info. Dietrich's work also indicted Brackhaven Press Secretary Edmund Jeffries, who disappeared just after the election. He grabbed a bunch of money from the City Workers Retirement Fund and bolted. Dietrich's work connected him with the Mayan cutter Sean Walker, and using Dietrich's files, Jeffries was found and indicted of fraud, conspiracy, and murder by Seattle District Attorney Dana Oakes on December 24, 2074. Of course, Brackhaven was involved in all that, but he walked due to his connections and allowing Jeffries to take the fall. I tell ya, Brackhaven is more slippery than a butter eel in a bag of oil. With Brackhaven once again safe in the governor's mansion, the racism in Seattle continued unabated. For example, when three elf bodies were found outside Renton City Hall a few weeks later, the public comment could be summed up in one phrase. Whatever, they were just dandelion eaters. Well, you'd think by 2074 we'd be better than that. But we're not. Alas. To close out Seattle's 2074, Remembrance Day was declared an official local holiday. Since 2069, survivors and family of those lost during the Renraku Arcology shutdown had been gathering to remember and honor those who were killed or otherwise lost to their families. Of course, not even that sort of thing could go by without becoming violent, but I guess it was the thought that counts. In the corporate news, 2074 saw corporate court justice Yoshiko Hino make a series of decisions inconsistent with his previous rulings, and which were completely and transparently siding with Aztec technology in every case. Of course, as Hino was Evo's appointment, relations between Evo and Aztec technology began to grow very close. To find out more about this particular situation, see the Neo-Anarchist Podcast CFD special. Horizon's odd relationship with Technomancers came to a surprising climax in 2074. In the early 70s, Horizon was one of the few corps willing to give merit to Technomancer rights, and for their trouble, Technomancers rallied outside of Horizon corporate buildings to protest. Seeing a sympathetic ear, the protesters tried to get Horizon to take the next step for Technomancers and grant them full citizenship. They wanted Horizon to work for Technomancer rights universally. The protests were a nuisance, but ultimately were a net positive for Horizon, which was getting free press. But when a bored Technomancer hacked a Horizon executive email account, they found Horizon staff describing the protesters as, and I quote, useful idiots. Of course, being called names is never fun, but being called useful makes people start wondering. When the Technomancers started digging deeper, they discovered Horizon was taping the protests and sending the footage to casinos in Las Vegas as proof that Technomancers were unruly and should be banned from Vegas casinos. Now, understandably, Technomancers felt betrayed and started attacking Horizon. In 2074, a group of Technomancers plotted an attack against the Vegas economic heart when they took down the Matrix access for the entire Pueblo Corporate Council for a few hours. When the Matrix was restored, images of over 500 dead Technomancers exploded all over the Matrix. And while Horizon pulled overtime in spinning the footage, Technomancers worldwide soured on Horizon, and many actively hate the corp for lying to them, for using them, and finally, for killing so many of them. Some of you might remember Soul Media. Soul Media was responsible for breaking the Mersai scandal of 2051, which exposed fraud at Spinrad Industries and ended up costing Spinrad his AA status. Well, he got his AA status back in 2074 and started moving heaven and earth to return the favor. And the shadows of 2074 were thick with money from Spinrad Industries, going after both Soul Media and Soul CEO Marina Nidos. Maybe, in light of recent events, I don't need to tell you that he was wildly successful and ended up buying Soul Media just a few years later. It's poetic in a way. In February, the corporate court resolved a long-standing case involving the will of a Mr. Patrick Goodman. Goodman was the late CEO of Cavalier Arms Limited of Amarillo, Texas. His successor, Derek Robert Kane, was being denied Goodman's stock due to a suit brought by Neonet CEO Richard Villiers. Villiers contested the will, but Cavalier Arms' new owners, Reality Inc., argued Neonet no longer had contractual power of attorney over Goodman's estate, which they had assumed after Goodman's murder in 2063. The court ruled that Kane be awarded the stock and the board seat that goes along with them. From March 3rd to 9th, Yamatetsu Nautical Technologies had five of their aircraft fall apart mid-flight. Completely random. In July, Johnny Spinrad hosted the Wu Quintuplets at a lavish party, which was well-publicized and painted the Quints and Johnny as BFFs forever. During a Desert Wars battle on August 11th, the Ares Delta Dogs fought the Mojave Rattlers. The Rattlers' equipment, all from Cavalier Arms, spontaneously failed to operate. I can't imagine why either, and I just know that Neonet was all broken up about it too. Shockingly, on September 5th, Nicholas Young Nick Aurelius threw himself from an airplane while on the way to Detroit. Internally, Ares communicated Young Nick committed suicide, and the public story was some bulldrek about a parachuting incident. That is, of course, a bunch of fragging crapola. Wasp spirits were attacking the plane, and Nick bailed out rather than be given in to their mercies. Nicholas Aurelius II was the son of Leonard Aurelius and the grandson of Nicholas Aurelius I, and was manager of Cross Advanced Electronics, major stockholder at Ares. Would it surprise you to discover that young Nick was just about to spoil Damian Knight's carefully crafted plans for using bug spirits as his own personal army? Young Nick wanted to use the bugs that Ares had been experimenting on to fight against other bugs, but Knight wouldn't hear of it. He wanted the bugs for himself. What? You didn't know that Ares was in deep with bug spirits? Yeesh. In November, Mitsuhama bought into Matrix Infrastructure Manufacturing to the tune of 130 billion New Yen. This was with an eye looking ahead to the new Matrix coming into effect. More on that later. Proteus's aquacology construction around the Strait of Gibraltar caused a series of earthquakes that caused engineers to question the feasibility of construction in that area, while a rumored security breach of Neonet servers caused the Great Dragon and major Neonet shareholder Keladir to assure the NEEC authorities that the breach was quite minor and that no critical data was stolen. Of course, he didn't know that it was all uploaded to Jackpoint, and it wasn't very minor. Well, the year in magic was eventful as well. The mana lines around the Yellowstone Wilderness Refuge began to surge in power. The Yellowstone shamans usually are to keep things pretty quiet there, but no amount of hard work on their part was going to stop this train from coming. I have a few theories about why the mana lines were surging, none of them good. This relates to the events that happened later in 2078, but we'll get there in time. It is possible that the events surrounding Azatlan's confrontation with the Great Dragon Sarurg caused the swell. I also have a theory concerning ancient and forbidden arcana, concerning possibly old dragons and their connection to Yellowstone, but that is the kind of info that gets street shamans killed, so I'll leave it there. My gut feeling is that both of these possibilities affected the other and gave us the 4 years of Yellowstone fluctuations that led to the Yellowstone event of 2078. Needless to say, the surge caused all non-essential personnel to be banned from Yellowstone, but many of you will surely remember being able to see the Yellowstone mana lines with your naked eye. Awakened critters were fleeing the area like it was on fire. UCAS Special Forces discovered multiple terrorist cells infected with insect spirits in Toronto, while in March, UK's Royal Botanical Garden became the first to display ostascoques. And in LA, protesters lobbied for days to legalize the purchase of the Yon Orchid for personal use. In the technology department, February saw Mitsuhama's SafeTrix technology firewall test well enough to receive the award for being the most effective system against Technomancer assaults. Independently tested at MIT&T, SafeTrix gained popularity in the consumer market quickly, with the Technomancer scare still fresh in people's minds. In April, Julian Sergetti, Sadr Krupp's chief political lobbyist, organized a presentation by a woman named Danielle Delamar. She spoke to the new European Economic Community about the possibility of new Matrix controls, protocols, and the possibility of rebuilding and restructuring the Matrix itself. Later in April, all contact with Evo's Gagarin Mars base was lost. Contact with the largest Martian base would not be restored until August, 130 days later. Of course, those who have listened to the CFD special would know that the monads were involved in this, and it was really just the first step of what would become a nightmare for many. Following up on her presentation in April, Danielle Delamar wasted no time in gathering more steam for her Matrix agenda. Prior to April, Delamar had only been particularly active in Europe with corporations like Sadr Krupp, the NEEC, and with the Grand Tour. The Grand Tour, if you've forgotten, is the jet-setting rich people tour that exists for no purpose whatsoever than to gather and display the wealth and lifestyle of the richest people on the planet, presumably to remind us all how poor everyone else is. But after her April presentation to the NEEC, she has opened up lobbying firms in Paris, London, Manhattan, and DC. She got a coalition together of everyone who could possibly benefit from a more controlled Matrix. Everyone from family values lobbyists to anti-porn legislators to corpse tired of hackers getting all up in their nodes. And she formed a group called a Responsible Matrix for Prosperity Group. And she got what she wanted. On December 1st, Danielle Delamar announced new Matrix grids and protocols being implemented, maintained by the corporate court itself, and she softened the blow by promising free and universal Matrix access worldwide. 2074 was busy in the shadows as well, especially it seems for serial killers. In January, Knight Errant released a report that identified Teresa Castillo from Galveston, Texas as the Mealtime Killer, who claimed responsibility for 23 deaths over 7 months. For those not in the know, the Mealtime Killer was a vampire serial killer who used some of the blood of their victims to write what meal they served as, a snack or dinner, brunch, breakfast, etc. After Teresa was dealt with, there came a copycat killer using the same MO as the original. Both were eventually killed. A few months later, in March, anti-infected lobbyists pointed to the mealtime killer and assorted copycats as reasons that the infected rights group should be dismissed. In April, on the one-year anniversary of the mealtime killer's first reported victim, copycat killings took place all over the world. I'll let you little crows in on a little secret, if you don't mind. These copycat killings were all orchestrated by vampire supremacy group called Fear the Dark. It was them that empowered the mealtime killer in the first place. They inspired, hired, and facilitated the copycats as well. They didn't, and still do not, care to coexist with other metahumans. They see themselves as apex predators, meant to take what they want. Further, one of the leaders of Fear the Dark created a drug called Renfield. Created from vampire blood, it allows vamps to live virtually indefinitely in symbiosis with a non-vampire, while virtually ignoring any essence loss. This is how they ensure the loyalty of their underlings. And crows, this is just one reason why the infected rights movement has been stumbling and falling. Bounties on the infected continue to rise, their urges are becoming stronger for unknown reasons, and an increased allergy to sunlight is pushing them further and further into the darkness. As a result, more infected are joining up with Fear the Dark, or moving to Asimondo. Bad news for everyone, crows, even the infected, in my opinion. Those Fear the Dark fraggers made one last splash in 2074 when, on December 7th, they publicly outed Martin DeVries as a vampire at his book signing in Houston. Whether they meant to kill him or just reveal the truth is unknown, but when six vampires attack, you can probably assume that they wanted more harm than truth. Either way, the vampire hunter turned vampire story author was outed as a vamp himself on international media. But on to other serial killers. Following up on the 2073's We Are Free killings, Marcus Killinger kills again in Washington. These killings got their name because the murderer left behind the words We Are Free scrawled in blood at the scenes. This time, Killinger was joined by a troll as a second We Are Free killer. In June, Minuteman officer in charge of investigating the We Are Free killers, Tyler Lane, became a suspect himself in a We Are Free killing, and then he disappeared. Finally, in July, We Are Free killings took place all over the world. I told you serial killing was a big deal in 2074. Anyway, these weren't vampire killings. Rather, after doing some digging, I found out these killings were linked to CFD infection, the e-ghosts and AI that had been trapped and experimented on by Neonet, Evo, and Aztechnology finally gained their freedom and escaped into metahumans, and that transition period isn't always great. In fact, many of those AI and e-ghosts were downright hostile, and they still continue to be. So expect a difficult time for any monads or e-ghosts or AI trying to find sympathy as the chaos continues. February 13th was the last time the toxic lion shapeshifter shaman known as Artoxius was spotted in Hong Kong. Not surprising given the high bounty placed on his head by Sauter Krupp. Now, Artaxius had been known to associate with neo-anarchist cells, and all of his attacks were against corporate targets, and his motivation was to avenge the loss of the hunting grounds, the poaching of endangered lions, and the capture of lions by the rich who made pets of them. So, while I dislike any toxic magic whatsoever, I find it really hard to blame the guy for, well, almost anything, really. Anyway, while he hasn't officially been seen since 2074, I can tell you that Artaxius has joined up with an extremist neo-anarchist group called Overreach, based in South Africa, and is still active. Sadly, a member of the virtual private host for Shadowrunners called Jackpoint made her final post on October 19th. Black Mamba warned the Shadow community that exposure to Blue 227 could cause a blood fury in metahumanity. Blue 227, an artificial toxin that, when mixed with dragon's blood, acts as a coagulant or anticoagulant depending on the chemical mixture and how much oxygen is present. Mamba discovered the side effect and was killed in action soon after. In December, a routine knight-errant sweep found 300 kilograms of tempo in a warehouse in the Puyallup Barrens. While those responsible were never identified, the overall flow of tempo into Seattle seemed to be lessening as time went on. On Christmas Day, Milwaukee Mafia capo Doug Mad Dash Asher and his family were found dead inside their home. Mad Dash was slain execution style and a white ceramic bird was left next to the body. And now for your most favoritist, if shortest, part of the podcast, the culture part of 2074. The two top movies of 2074 were, number one, the Shadowrunner melodrama called They Called Him Hierophant, and two, Seelies, which was an animated family drama set in the Seelie Court. I have seen both of those and I felt like I wasted my time, but not as badly as you have wasted an entirely good slot of time listening to the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. In closing, I want to give a hearty hello to our newest Patreon supporters, which receive monthly offerings of Neo-Anarchist Street gear. Freshly included in this illustrious list of capable crow funders is Will, Thomas Malloy, David Dubois, Scott Starks, Rory Greer, and Rasian. Thank you all. Everything that you need to set up and maintain Neo-Anarchist cells in your area, which includes new stickers every month, patches, pins, dice bags, fake sins, contact sheets for Opti and his crew, USB cred sticks, Black Star t-shirts, whiskey glasses, temporary tattoos, Black Star dog tags, and a new tier where you can game monthly with Opti and friends will be delivered to your safe house as we march bravely on. The music serving as the background to Audible Anarchy was written by the legend Marshall Parker and reimagined by Unanimium 88. This was the Neo-Anarchist Podcast, and I am your host, the Big Check, What the Heck, Cheek Peck, Colin Beck, WM Keck, Hit the Deck, Punch the Neck, Anti-Corpsec, Low-Tech, Train Wreck of a Host, Opti. Enjoy your freedom, but don't use it to be a serial killer. What a waste.